Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
David Adjaye's controversial Holocaust memorial approved following inquiry. Garden Museum reveals Lambeth Green Pavilion finalists. Visitors to MVRDV's contentious Marble Arch Mound issued refunds. And the enormous glowing sphere which may soon be gracing East London's skyline. My name is Merlin Fulcher, I'm an architectural journalist, and I will be bringing you a roundup of this week's top London architecture news. Welcome to the Lundown. My special guest this week is Gillian Darley. Gillian is an architectural historian and writer. Welcome to the show.
Very pleased to be here.
Our first story this week was featured in The AJ and The Guardian and covers the planning approval of David Adjaye's controversial Holocaust memorial. Housing Minister Christopher Pincher has given the go-ahead to Adjaye and Ron Arad's competition-winning proposal for a memorial and visitor centre in the Grade 2 listed Victoria Tower Gardens. This highly contested decision, made in line with the planning inspector's advice, follows multiple redesigns, protests, and a public inquiry held last October. The controversy surrounding this government-backed scheme is principally concerned with its location in the small park next to the Houses of Parliament. In 2017, then Housing Minister Esther McVeigh called in the plans in a last-minute turnaround just hours before Parliament dissolved and 3 months before Westminster City Council unanimously rejected the scheme. Following the submission of the latest revised designs in 2019, Pincher conceded that the scheme was not in line with the local development plan. He said harm would be caused to the setting of heritage assets, including Westminster Abbey and Parliament Square Conservation Area, and also the Buxton Memorial Fountain, and that for all these reasons, this weighed considerably against the proposals. Yet despite this, in finally approving the scheme, the minister said these points were outweighed by, quote, a series of very significant public benefits. The Board of Deputy British Jews has welcomed this £100 million scheme, and Adjaye, who designed the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and won last year's Royal Gold Medal, described Pincher's decision as, quote, a huge milestone in bringing this project to reality. However, there has also been significant pushback from objectors, including Westminster City Council, local community groups, and some Jewish leaders and Holocaust survivors. Architect Barbara Weiss, founder of the Save Victoria Tower Gardens campaign group, said the government's decision to grant planning permission was not the end of the battle against the memorial. Weiss also questioned whether there was a potential conflict of interest in a government-backed project being decided by ministers after being called in by the government itself before Westminster City Council had had a chance to refuse it. Construction of the memorial is expected to begin next year and complete by 2025. So, Gillian, would you be able to paint a picture of Adjaye's designs and how they sit within this sensitive site?
Well, from what I can see, it sits tucked into the end of the site. It's a very strong design of multiple fins. I think it's 22. It's a symbolic number. I mean, I'm completely, my head is in a whirl over the labyrinthine political, the levels of of influence, the levels of view, the levels of push and pull here. But actually, I think it's completely in the wrong place as the building, or as the project, is supposed to be two completely different things. One is memory, and the other is to alert us, to remind us, and to keep something running in our heads forever.
That's very, very interesting. I mean, certainly in some ways I share some of those thoughts in that park. It's an enigmatic park, but it's also quite sort of weird and windswept and almost entirely inhabited by journalists or politicians. And it's not really a place that the kind of is seen as a great focus for the public, so to speak. Is there any thoughts on, you know, how this particular spot has ended up to be quite so divisive? Because I think a lot of commentators, I know some campaigners are based quite near to it, but a lot of other people who are really heated up at this about this basically never go to that park at all and never really spend any time in it.
It's very strange, of course, now, given that the Palace of Westminster is a sort of embattled site with all its security devices. I mean, I was hopping over barriers and I was sort of chicaning on my feet, you know, towards it, you know, because I happened to be walking through Parliament Square. And, you know, that's a very unpromising start. And it has to be said, I mean, this is going to be a site, if it is built on this site, it is going to be subject to the tightest and most particular security. And I don't know that anybody has really factored that in to the discussion, because, you know, it's a horrible experience coming, as I say, past the Palace of Westminster, largely on security grounds. I mean, what will this bring to it? So, I mean, this is not so much a, you know, it's not a fine detail of design. It's a kind of conceptual crash point.
So it's quite interesting. If we look back at the genesis of this project, basically it goes back to 2014 when the then Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced the commission to establish a permanent Holocaust memorial. And it was going to be at one of three locations in London, including the potential for it being at the Imperial War Museum, which isn't too far away from the proposed site of the current memorial. And obviously, also the Imperial War Museum itself has a very significant and important Holocaust exhibition that's been there for the past 21 years. So in the 7 years since this genesis, the site has now moved to the very doorstep of Parliament itself. Was this potentially a political move? And why is it so powerful to place it this memorial right next to the Palace of Westminster? I mean, what's significant about the interpretation space that goes with this memorial is it's to be dedicated to Jewish people who came to Britain and were welcomed in Britain and created amazing lives here. But then also, there is the point to be made about, you know, what role did Britain's Parliament play in responding to the Holocaust during the Second World War, for example? And is there some who are arguing, could this be potentially rewriting history?
I mean, I completely concur with that. And the Imperial War Museum is, without doubt, the place for this. And, I mean, you know, they have a track record in conveying this history, this story, this shocking reality. And if there's money to be, you know, saved, then it should go into the most in-depth education drive to make sure that the next generation aren't in the position of not knowing about the Holocaust. I mean, how will walking into that little green space and seeing some golden fins and then proceeding to the box below really deal with any of that? It's a societal problem. It's not a built problem. And I may say this, I'm echoing discussions with Jewish friends. I mean, this is not, it doesn't divide opinion, it just hasn't really struck a chord in its current place. So the minister may have said, let's go for it. But, you know, I don't believe that it's got legs.
So one of the interesting things about this story and this debate is that it comes at a time where, you know, because of the pandemic, we've seen the pressures on green spaces, especially in a city like London, but also the massive injustices that exist around access to open areas. I mean, the approval of this project, which will take up a chunk of Victoria Tower Gardens, which, if you live in that neighbourhood, is one of the few small green bits of open free space available to you. Yeah, is that possibly another thing to look at here? In that this isn't just about the memorial. It's about a kind of creeping paving over or semi-public privatization of what had for more than a century been safeguarded for public openness.
Well, it's certainly a very odd message to put about if you're saying, here's another green space which you're not going to have anymore because the security implications are such that there will be no way that you can just meander through. It's sort of on the list of counter-arguments. I would say that it's actually quite low because if there's one thing that the COVID months have done for us, it's to give us a sense of how lucky we are with our green spaces. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, some tiny, you know, Phoenix Gardens behind Shaftesbury Avenue, or it's my favourite, St George's Gardens, or all these central London gardens, which just have completely, you know, they've been our sort of, you know, the key to the padlock. And I think I'm not sure that this particular little green space has quite such weight as that.
You are listening to The Lundown, a weekly news show brought to you by Open City. We rely on support from people like you to make this show. So if you like The Lundown and want to support our work, please share the link, leave us a review on iTunes, and consider becoming an Open City friend. The Lundown is supported by Adobe, makers of software including Photoshop, InDesign, and Audition, the program we use to edit this show. Go to open-city.org.uk/Adobe to sign up for a special discounted subscription to the Adobe Creative Suite for as little as £9.99 a month, and Adobe will donate to Open City for everyone who signs up. Our second story, again featured in the AJ, takes us just across the River Thames to Lambeth Green, which is on the other side of the river from Victoria Tower Gardens. The Garden Museum, which sits next to Lambeth Bridge, has announced the 6 shortlisted teams in its open contest for a new landmark pavilion on the green. Mary Duggan Architects, Charles Holland Architects, Ros Barr Architects, and Rising Stars Cook Fawcett Architects have all been chosen to proceed to the next phase of the contest. New solo practitioner William Guthrie, and a collaboration between Bartlett graduates Adrian Yankee-Sui and Shikui Kikutu complete the shortlist. The competition sought sketch proposals for a new permanent building to be used by staff and volunteers to maintain Lambeth Green, a planned new 2.14-hectare park designed by Dan Pearson Studio. This new pavilion comes 4 years after Dow Jones Architects completed a new extension to the museum, which occupies Lambeth's Grade 2 listed former St Mary's Church and is next door to the Grade 1 listed Lambeth Palace and Reginald Blomfield and George Topham Forest's Grade 2 listed Lambeth Bridge. The latest contest sought ideas for a new permanent pavilion which integrates architecture with landscape design and horticulture. Moving into the next phase of the competition, the 6 shortlisted teams will now each receive £1,500 to develop their concepts ahead of the next round of judging in September. So, Gillian, this pavilion will be situated a mere stone's throw away from the Holocaust Memorial on the opposite bank of the Thames. The contestants face many of the same challenges, getting their designs to stand alongside key pieces of Grade 1 listed historic architecture and on the edges of a UNESCO World Heritage site. What do you think about how the 6 finalists have attempted to sensitively integrate their designs into this culturally significant site without damaging the wider heritage of the area? And could this contest fare better in terms of outcome than its high-profile neighbour across the river?
I love the Garden Museum, and I greatly admire the work that Dow Jones have done there, both Phase 1 and Phase 2. I know some people don't like the original conversion, but it works for me. It still speaks to me of the church. It also speaks to me of a sort of, it's not a very immediately legible arrangement of space. And for that, I love it. I mean, it's exploratory. It opens up new little corners. Each time I go there, I see something I haven't seen before. I love the way that they've incorporated the garden. And I'm not quite sure if they need a sort of, I mean, the word pavilion is, of course, it covers a multiplicity of outcomes. And I've looked through what I can see, and obviously these are a very much first phase intimations, but I think I saw a couple which were quite, as it were, structural, which involved a tower, or no, tower is an overstatement, but a form of entrance, a gateway, and others which were more to do with walling it in slightly and perhaps providing whatever this shelter that's required. I'm not quite sure whether it's to put buckets and spades in. I can't quite make out what the function is, and maybe that's the point. Maybe the function is to actually emerge with this discussion. And I notice that the judging team are all very much involved there. I mean, they haven't got outsiders there. They're all people right in the middle of the museum. So they know what they want, and I presume they're going to nudge the winner towards the outcome.
Our third story for a London architecture story, it's quite a rare thing, actually. This is one that's been covered in the national and international news media, including The Guardian, The Evening Standard, Washington Post, Forbes, and The New York Times. It's even kicked up a storm on Twitter. It's all to do with Dutch architect MVRDV's highly criticised Marble Arch Mound, which has been slammed by the public and critics alike. Described as a slag heap by early visitors, Westminster City Council has now offered refunds to the people who paid £4.50 to climb the mound last week after conceding the landmark was simply not ready for its opening. The £2 million temporary installation, similar to the one the same Rotterdam-based practice proposed for the Serpentine Pavilion 17 years ago, was commissioned to entice crowds back to Oxford Street, as the council pledged to do more to spruce up the shopping district following the pandemic. Manchester School of Architecture senior lecturer Rob Hyde described the mound on Twitter as, quote, pointless, while Assorted Skills and Talents director Christopher Boyce suggested it was, quote, a massive waste of time and material. The mound's creators, MVRDV, have defended the project, saying, quote, it is a vulnerable installation, no doubt, but we just need to give nature a bit of time. The architects also said that there was a serious message behind the mound about how important it is to add nature to cities to combat climate change. So, Gillian, what's this all about? MVRDV are a world-renowned Dutch architecture practice and are responsible for some truly amazing structures around the globe, frankly. Perhaps you could paint a picture of what happened here, why this installation at Marble Arch has delivered such a divisive outcome. And also, just reflecting on it, for people like us, especially at Open City and on this show, we often find ourselves championing architecture as a way forward for cities. Why is this outcome so troubling?
So I had a little scroll yesterday and I found Julia Payton-Jones, who was then heading up the programme of the pavilions at Serpentine, or head of the Serpentine, saying this was after, she was looking back on it from some years later, this was a valiant failure, she said. Is that the first line of what she said? Which is a little Vimeo clip anyone can watch. I mean, what were Westminster councillors or Westminster, whoever this was, what were they thinking? Do they not have the ability to do a little bit of checking, a little bit of research, to choose something which was regarded as, yes, so, you know, kind of parked on one side, a huge amount of money went into it, to develop it as far as it did at Serpentine, and they realised they couldn't do it. It was, in fact, going to wrap the entire Serpentine Gallery. So, well, when they come to Marble Arch, they're going to wrap the arch. Oh, surprise, surprise, it doesn't work. So then you've got this lump. And the lump, the other thing I did was looked at some of the... because it's going to give you a view, isn't it? That's what it's about. So you go up to the top. What do you get? You've got the Edgware Road. Now, I love the Edgware Road. I love, you know, delving around in those shops. I don't want to look down it from the top of a mole heap. As for the, it's getting ridiculous, you know, this notion of we've got to get green into the city. Where in heaven's name are they at Marble Arch? They're on the edge of the most sumptuous park, which goes from Hyde Park to Kensington Gardens. I haven't measured it, but we're talking an immense, you could do a very long, good walk by walking around the edges of that space. What do they need to have a peeling green lump for? I just feel terribly cynical. I mean, I'm sure, I realise that my screensaver on my mobile, and this is, you know, a vote for them, the architects, is that wonderful glass-fronted shop in Amsterdam, which I fell upon when I was last there. I love it. I mean, and the things they've done are all good fun, and I mean, not all good fun, but they're full of ideas and whatever. So Westminster come to them and say, you know, have you got some ideas for a pavilion? So, you know, they've got this enormous plan chest, and they go to the bottom drawer and they think, oh, here's one we did earlier, you know, like cookery shows, except it was a heroic failure.
Well, the council says the mound's purpose is to draw in crowds, and it doesn't necessarily seem to be doing that. You know, obviously the idea was to those crowds would be potential customers to the nearby shops. When you look at Westminster as a borough, though, it is like a hugely divided place. You've got some of London's richest neighbourhoods as well as its poorest, quite near to each other. And in that context, is this really a sensible way to invest £2 million, especially as we're just slowly emerging from a pandemic? You know, a thing like this, you have to pay to go up. Who does this serve? Is it about shopping visitors with spare cash, or, you know, how does this interact with struggling locals who've got the very real reality of balancing their rent, food and heating bills, and often failing to do so?
Well, the other thing is that I walked around the edge of Manchester Square the other day, and I thought, oh, I wouldn't half give, yeah, I'd give a lot to go in there, you know, and it's got very fierce notices about, you know, have to have a, you know, it's a keypad and the passcodes and things. Completely empty, of course, nobody in there. Beautifully tended. You know, there are squares one block in from Oxford Street. There are green spaces and squares all over the place, but I'm afraid to say almost all of them are private. And it seems to me that Westminster would do much better to have a strategy for at least summertime openings, so something substantial in the terms of giving back. And it occurs to me that perhaps the Green Lump is, to some extent, a sort of slightly peevish response to the fact they were going to pedestrianise Oxford Street, weren't they? And that was rebuffed. And I don't think that a pedestrian main thoroughfare with whatever the percentage of closed shops will be when it all shakes out in the autumn, I don't think it's going to be somewhere you awfully want to walk. So I think they should be thinking much, much harder about what's ahead. And, you know, this is like a sort of public relations, you know, it's food poisoning, really, isn't it? I mean, they've given themselves norovirus.
And while we're on this topic of public realm improvements, I mean, if you look at the wider city of Westminster, there are some pretty impressive plans underway. For example, there's the pedestrianisation of Strand Aldwych. And not so long ago, Trafalgar Square was partially pedestrianised, and that's been like unequivocally a great success. So, I mean, it'd be quite interesting to hear your thoughts as an architectural historian, like what you could tell us about London's public realm and the history of how architects have changed it. Where are those really shining success stories? And then also, just thinking of that mound, in those years, was there ever any similarly weird kind of successful, unsuccessful or successful pop-up ventures that we could use to compare to this one?
I mean, I have to say on the substantial changes for the better, I mean, even the sort of loose fit, what they've done to the Strand already, I've always found that very successful. You know, the fact that you can you know, cross the road with. I mean, I know that if you're partially sighted, and there are always constituencies who aren't well served in any of these kind of changes. But I like that. I'm completely delighted that the church will be, St Mary le Strand will be finally released from, you know, it's like St Mary le Bow. You know, they're traffic islands. I mean, you know, the injustice really of these 18th century buildings awash with diesel fumes and the rest is really considerable. I mean, we got back, we got Somerset House back, you know, the car parking was taken away from there. I like Exhibition Road. I think, you know, I think we all jog along that scheme. It's not immediately super clear what's going on, but it works. I like it. You know, I think we've learned. And of course, where do we learn a lot of this from? Holland. the country of really, really good public realm. So, you know, I feel it's very sad that this particular blot that we've been talking about should come from that incredibly enlightened culture where their landscape architects and their architects work so well together.
So obviously we're a news review, media review show. So I thought it's quite interesting just now to reflect on the media response to the Marble Arch Mall, because it's been covered around the world. It's got tons of column inches. But is this potentially a bit disproportionate? I mean, yes, it is £2 million of public money. But in the same week, The Times has reported that Parliament has written off £70 million, which it spent on working up plans for a temporary debating chamber that was due to house members while the main building was being refurbished. It's not going ahead now. No one seems to be talking about that. Everyone's just piling on to the Marble Arch Mound.
The fact that the world's press is picking it up is a sort of... It's like a metaphor, really, for the present government, which is so frequently doing such, their foolishness is so stratospheric that foolishness on this microscopic level is easier to illustrate, but is nevertheless, it's a figurative illustration of where we are, and it doesn't really matter who designed it, and the fact it was drier at some point and wetter at another, so it wasn't sort of enormously well fitted. It's just a fiasco with not too many injured.
A final story this week appeared in The Guardian in an article written by its architecture critic Ollie Wainwright, previous guest on this show. It's all to do with the proposed Madison Square Gardens Stadium Sphere, which may soon be gracing Stratford's skyline. A planning application for a vast glowing orb as wide as the London Eye and nearly as tall as Big Ben, lit by 36 million LED lights, has been submitted and is scheduled to be voted on by the London Legacy Development Corporation, the LLDC, planning committee next month. Masterminded by New York's Madison Square Garden Company and designed by the architects Populous, the proposed 21,500 capacity MSG sphere will illuminate its entire surface with 24-hour near 360-degree advertising. The 1.9-hectare triangular site, which was bought by MSG for £60 million in 2017, sits between railway lines next to the Westfield Shopping Centre and close to the former Olympic Stadium, which was also designed by Populous. Local residents, councils, as well as neighbours the O2 Arena and West Ham Football Club have all objected to the proposed plans. Historic England has also warned that nearby conservation areas would be damaged by the stadium's size and, quote, intrusive disturbance on their settings. LLDC will decide on the planning proposal next month. Gillian, this is a true test for London's democratic planning process. Newham Council and neighbouring Hackney are both solidly against the proposal, as are local residents and some rival venues. Do you think this majority unelected members of the LLDC board will listen to local concerns? And if it does win approval, what does this say about the state of planning in 21st century Britain?
My answer is a question, which is how long does the LLDC have? It was post-2012. Are they coming to the end of a 10-year period? Anyway, what I'm saying is this is just an authority that doesn't have longevity in its makeup. And I don't know who its board members are. I remember a long time ago hearing what they hoped to do, but this one has come from the blue yonder, although obviously we could have worked it out if we'd seen who bought that piece of land. I'm amused to see an identical one is actually rising in Las Vegas. I mean, is Stratford the new Las Vegas? I mean, in which case, why is the V&A East going down there? Why is the Bartlett there? I find it very hard to grapple with this very seriously. I do not for one instant imagine that this could go, and I'm prepared to put money on it.
Nice. I've just checked. LLDC is planned to wind up in 2030. So that's 18 years after the games. But just thinking, just sort of zooming out a bit from the Olympic Park and looking at the wider story of development and renewal within London's East End. Is this the sort of architecture that we would have expected to see in a neighbourhood like, say, Stratford, for example, a few decades ago before the Olympics? And does it represent the sort of sustainable development that people living in what were called the so-called host boroughs, those are the ones surrounding the Olympic Park, which together face some of like the highest levels of poverty and disadvantage in the country? Is this the sort of thing that they might benefit from?
I've got myself, I can't quite remember why, very interested in what they were going to do in the different sort of gradations of the Olympic Park. And I go back fairly often, and I've had several over the years students looking at it from different aspects. And I feel, have been feeling very proud, really, of what was achieved and how, in a way, you know, there was a cordon sanitaire between what the park brought to the area. And has, you know, has left there intact. And then all the time there is this feeling of sort of something gnawing away, as if it was too good for them or too good for us, you know, it's like a sort of an envy of that space. And while some of the early student housing was fine and some of the housing blocks were carefully thought through, I just, you know, I sense a terrific amount of debasing going on and a terrific distancing of the place from a real community. And again, I mean, what are we seeing? We're seeing things sold off, planned far away, you know, it's you know, lost its, it shows signs of losing its moorings. You know, I don't underplay what they've hit amidships, the COVID crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, bread and circuses, come on. Don't want that.
I hear you on that. And certainly, if I think of the Olympic Park, I think those amazing connections going between areas which had otherwise been cut off from each other, you know, cut-throughs which had been practically no-go zones for young people growing up in those areas. That is a real spirit of what it's achieved. The fact that you can go from Hackney Wick to Leytonstone in kind of style and elegance all on one level without going up a flight of stairs. And a giant sphere on a triangular railway corner doesn't really speak of that. You know, it's not really part of that. But look, regular listeners to the show will know that we love to talk about the climate crisis and the impact of the construction industry on the environment. We want to hold the industry to account. We talk about the scale of embodied carbon, the cost of demolition. Surely, you know, we all know now that we need to be building structures that are adaptable when we think about all of this stuff and can be altered to fit evolving needs. So is this the kind of architecture, this sphere, that we really should be continuing to erect across the city? You know, can you see an energy and capitally intensive structure like this surviving the many changes we're likely to face in the coming decades, especially, like, as you hinted at, you know, the rise of outdoor entertainment, people doing more things at home as well in the wake of the pandemic?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid this is where the inner cynic comes out in me. I mean, it's just an advertising hoarding. That's what it is. I mean, the 21,500 people who are going to sit inside, I mean, it doesn't tell us what they're going to be doing or why they would be want to be there. Why don't they just, you know, why don't they just say it's going to be a very sophisticated set of thrilling advertising? I don't feel terribly generous towards it, put it that way.
Gillian, it's been a great pleasure to have you on The Lundown this week. I hope you can join us again soon. You mentioned your book, and perhaps you could tell listeners a little bit more about it, and also where listeners can stay up to date on the things you're doing, your socials, where you publish your articles and so on.
Well, the book went into paperback this April. I celebrate Essex really as a place that people, I think what's very interesting is people on the whole don't really get Essex until they move a bit away. And my ideal audience, I always say to people, is the Essex diaspora.
Gillian Darley, author of Excellent Essex in Praise of England's Most Misunderstood County, thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Lundown, a show from Open City, rounding up the big stories in architecture and the built environment each week in London. If you've enjoyed the show and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to the Architect's Journal, which has covered all these issues and many more too. You can find the show on Twitter or Instagram at Open City London, or by using the hashtag Lundown, LNDDWN. Open City receives no public funding, so if you want to support our work, please go to open-city.org.uk/support and sign up as an Open City friend. Open City is dedicated to making London a more open, accessible, and equitable city.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.